Greetings and welcome to Archive Chats, the series where we chat about all the amazing stories hidden in the archives that our LSC historians are uncovering. This first episode, Botanists in the Belly of Britannia, Plants and an Imperial Project, is with Dr. Catherine Arnold, a recent graduate from the department whose research focuses on German natural history collectors in South Africa during the 19th century. We hope you enjoy the episode. So right off the bat, let's start with a really broad question. Did Germany have an empire before it was even a nation?
So that's a difficult question. Of course, Germany didn't have a formal empire before 1871 when it became a nation state. But you could argue that Germany was certainly involved in imperial or colonial pursuits. So there's the classic work by Suzanne Zantop called Colonial Fantasies, which came out in about 1997, which historians of German imperialism have used to kind of draw on, that Germany certainly had imperial desires prior to the formation of its nation state. And there has been subsequent work done on sort of German Orientalism, whether Germany purely had intellectual interest in the Orient, or whether this kind of turned into more overt motives of political and economic informal control, which historians haven't really come to a consensus about. So there's a nice historiographical debate going on about the extent to which Germany had formal interests in the Orient, or whether we can call that informal imperialism. But there are also more nebulous ways that Germany and the German states were involved in imperial and colonial pursuits. And I found this one pathway. That science actually was one of the ways that the German states could connect themselves to more informal imperial pursuits.
Right, yeah, that's certainly interesting. It is certainly something within the historiography about whether or not Germany had imperial desires in a formal or informal sense before they were unified in 1871. I think we can just, before we delve down into your pathway of investigation, let's sort of zoom back out a bit and just latch on to those key terms. What really is the difference, if there is any, between formal and informal imperialism or colonialism? And is there any real worth for historians or even the popular media in distinguishing between the two of them?
Absolutely. So informal imperialism we can consider as direct control. So whether that be political, economic, military control, and into another state. So control over the territories and peoples of another place. Whereas informal control, we kind of think of as a sphere of influence. And so these spheres of, the idea of informal imperialism can mean loads of things. And I think that's where people are starting to really find the more interesting roots into imperialism and colonialism in recent sort of histories on science, missionary work, things like mercantile relations. I think this root of informal imperialism is where we're finding, the word I love is nebulous, I just used it, but where we find these nebulous sort of indirect and difficult to detect forms of control and power and othering and difference that we associate with formal imperialism or formal colonialism. But actually, they existed in more informal ways. So I do think there is merit in distinguishing between the two, and actually that the more interesting forms of imperialism may lie in informal imperialism. I think formal imperialism is more direct. We have lots of source material which can tell us about direct control, economic control, political control, but it's finding these other ways of detecting power and detecting, the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized, where we can have more interesting conversations about the nature of imperialism itself.
Well, I think I definitely agree with you on the fact that informal colonialism and informal imperialism certainly seeming to be a much more interesting topic of investigation than the formal narratives which we've grown accustomed to. I think there's definitely a misassumption that historians are now starting to really challenge, which is that colonialism involves a formal sort of imposition of government control from another country, in the sense that the British and French empires, to use the more recent examples you use. But in an age where we have a sort of post-colonial age, we have to remember that colonialism still very much has hidden so to speak, hidden and in these indeed informal influences, which still linger even after the formal imperialism, the formal control has disappeared. So let's just get straight into your research then. Let's talk about your research and talk about how it's sort of related to the idea of informal imperialism and Germanic ideas of an empire, I suppose.
Absolutely. So the initial conclusion, the sort of broad umbrella, which my research falls into, was that I noticed that although imperial history embraced the onset of global history, it seemed to ignore the presence of Europe and Europeans. So there's a little bit of work being done in this regard about the inclusion of Europe and Europeans into conceptions of the British Empire. So to what extent were Europeans involved in these pursuits? And we see this now in this sort of informal imperialism. So using the British Empire as a conduit by which these colonial fantasies could be realized. So that's kind of the umbrella of the topic. But I used German natural history collectors as a way to say, actually, you know, these Europeans were fundamentally enmeshed in the sort of human, material, and intellectual networks of the British Empire, which really revealed sort of an intersection between different conceptual approaches, emergent methods, and historiographies, which are completely disparate from one another, but which I tried to bring into the same frame. So there's a lot about sort of, you know, as I said, bringing this idea, you know, overthrowing the historiographical consensus on Suzanne Zamtop's approach in colonial fantasies. So questioning to what degree colonialism was actually a fantasy in pre-nation state and pre-imperial Germany, which offers a sort of timely intervention into contemporary discussions on the role of colonialism in memory politics in Germany today. So this is kind of centered around the building of the Humboldt Forum, which just opened this year. But also there's a place here, I call this a void, because in 1820, when Sir Joseph Banks passed away, he was sort of, he's been termed the presiding genius of exploration for the British Empire in the late 18th and early 19th century. So when he passed away in 1820, some historians have called this a decline of Kew Gardens or the decline of science in Britain in general. I call this more of a stagnation. I think decline is too serious, but this allowed for a moment where more interesting characters could fill that void, and also a moment where taxonomic and morphological determinations of more unusual plants could take precedence rather than plants of economic or agricultural value, which is kind of how we see, you know, botany, you know, focused on. So we see things like sugar and tobacco, tea, you know, these kind of things are traditional. But then we can talk about things like parasitic plants, because parasitic plants fundamentally disrupted, you know, the process of systematic botany. So this enables us to highlight the depth and complexity of the actual collections held in botanic gardens today, which are not utilitarian or even useful at all, but they were intellectual puzzles for botanists in the past. And this left a space as well for the German states or continental Europe to actually be at the forefront of the understanding of the flora of the British Empire until, you know, the two Hookers, William Jackson Hooker and Joseph Dalton Hooker, both took over Kew Gardens in the 1840s and 1850s and then established the Colonial Floras Project.
Right, that's definitely, it's interesting that we sort of have this notion of a sort of a homogenous British Empire, which was indeed ruled and the networks were run by Britons. But as you definitely showed, that was far from the case. Europeans, in this case Germans, were indeed invited and they took part with great agency in these networks. So there's a lot of ground here that I think we'll investigate in a bit. But just for the first sort of follow-up question, we've heard discussions about imperial networks, both now and in research that's similar to the one that you carried out. So how did these nature collectors, how did these botanists contribute to or challenge these networks, even when while they were still being formed in South Africa or indeed at larger parts of the British Empire?
Yeah, so the network theory is a huge kind of part of British imperial historiography now and has expanded, is essentially part of sort of the global history method now. And what's interesting is the way that I think about it is that, you know, these people existed in an overlapping and dense everyday social networks, which straddled national borders. They linked migrants to their places of settlement, to their places of origin. They generated trust and solidarity, improved the quality and quantity of information flows, and sort of combined cultural and economic pursuits. So this is kind of how I envision these networks. So they certainly worked within these kinds of networks, which the British Empire provided. But these, in a sense, they challenged these networks because they operated often outside of British state-structured or imperial-structured networks. They very rarely traveled on British ships. They very rarely sent their specimens back on British ships because they were more expensive. They stayed connected to Amsterdam or Hamburg or Bremen because those ships were cheaper and ultimately landed their specimens at home where they wanted them. So in a sense, they worked outside of those, out of those boundaries. In South Africa itself, they very rarely needed the permission of the colonial government, except for hunting or establishing themselves as a burgher or a citizen of South Africa. And so only in very, very official moments are they interacting with the colonial state in South Africa. Otherwise, they were just out, you know, they were out of the law almost, although they do come in conflict with the law sometimes. And so I argue that they actually had a greater affinity to the Boers than they did with any British person. The British were much more, quote, foreign to them, these Germans, than the Boers, who they had an affinity with because of their sort of shared cultural homeland, cultural linguistic homeland. But they did participate in civic society in the Cape and in South Africa, but they used it to their advantage. They didn't participate if they didn't have to. So you have people who really, you know, they relied completely on the networks of the British Empire, but they also lived outside of those networks as well. And I think living outside of those networks actually, you know, in a similar sense to this informal empire, working outside of the networks that the British Empire provided actually tells a more interesting story about how people use networks.
Yes, it's definitely an interesting story, I think. I think from what you've said, I would perhaps argue, or at least tentatively point towards the conclusion that these agents were not necessarily challenging the networks of the empire, but rather than circumventing them and indeed utilizing them to their advantage, insofar as it facilitated their collection of specimens and, of course, their taxonomic and botanical operations within the Cape and South Africa. So focusing then on that sort of geographical span, of course, your time frame focuses mainly on the early 1800s to the mid 1800s, with a bit of overlap into the 1860s, if I'm not mistaken. This is, of course, the time when South Africa is still being colonized very much by the British. And there's, of course, the conflicts with the Zulus and the Boers in the region as well. How do these nature collectors fit into the sort of social and political fabric, if you will, of this proto-empire, if you will, in South Africa?
You know, I would argue that they sat very uncomfortably into South African life. They certainly integrated to an extent. So James Bellich calls Germans in the British Empire sort of the third hull of the Anglo-Trimarian alongside the British and the Irish. So Germans were certainly present and had integrated or had assimilated to a certain extent during the period of the Dutch East India Company. So there were loads of people who they had this affinity with. And so in a sense, they certainly integrated into this sort of Boer lifestyle of hospitality and community, which is even today something that Afrikaners pride themselves on, is their, you know, their hospitality. But as the empire, or as the British become more established after taking over in 1806, and as we see a more British style of imperialism or in colonialism happening in South Africa, I find that these Germans really, they don't integrate quite as well as you would hope. They tend to integrate better out in the periphery, we could call it, or the frontier of South Africa than they do in Cape Town in the center in civic society. And this isn't, you know, a hard and fast situation. There are plenty of Germans who, you know, become embedded in the colonial government. For example, Ludwig Pape becomes the colonial botanist, the first colonial botanist of South Africa, of the Cape Colony. But the collectors really take it upon themselves to act kind of outside of the boundaries of British colonialism. But they also definitely take on the guise of the colonizer. And I think that has to do with their affinity towards the Boers and a particular legacy that was left by Dutch, by slavery during the Dutch rule of the Dutch East India Company. So this is, we talk about sort of a really, really violent imposition of labor, the violent sort of legacy of people being paid in alcohol, which we see still, you know, in the wine farms in Stellenbosch today, call this the DOP system. So they operate within this sort of cost-benefit analysis, which white agricultural, usually Afrikaner or Boer sort of landowners also, you know, viewed their labor. So it's interesting because they just straddle this line between British and Boer, and they don't sit comfortably within anything really. But they this is where I kind of say they have a tacit changeable identity, because they take the parts that they like and they kind of mold their identity around it. They use the British, the colonial government and colonial civic society when they need it, but then they escape from it when they're out in the frontier collecting, and then they take on, you know, more of the identity of the Boers that they see. So it's an uncomfortable place that they are within this sort of growing British colony.
Well, uncomfortable it may have been, I think that's certainly something which stood out, but I think it is also interesting how they sort of, what you mentioned, they mix and match parts of the identities of the British and the Boers as it sees fit to them to ensure that their operations can continue and that their activities can go unhindered pretty much. It also is really interesting that there's an affinity between Boers and these German nature collectors as well. I see some sort of continuity there within my own research. It might help to explain why during the Boer Wars in the late 1800s, there was rather vocal German support for the Boers rather than the British, which was rather upsetting, even because, of course, by this stage, the Germans were a formal empire and Kaiser Wilhelm II had desires for more land in Africa, shall we say. But of course, focusing then on the Boers, of course, we have to acknowledge that these operations were not taking place in a vacuum. They were very much operating on land, on the veld, so to speak, which Boers and other local tribes were living in and called home probably for generations. How did these botanists then interact with those tribes in further detail? And was there a sort of disruption by their activities, or were there any sort of infringements on their own rights as the people who've been stewarding that land in a way?
Absolutely. And this is actually one of the more interesting parts that came out of my PhD, I think. You know, there's new research being done on the so-called go-between. So these are sort of cultural interlocutors who sort of translate a cultural experience. So these are usually indigenous assistants who can bring Europeans into local life and say, this is why we use this. This is how we understand this animal within our society. And they sometimes, you know, these are the people who then sometimes go to Europe and exist within Europe, or they bring sort of Europeans into their world. You know, and this happened in Southeast Asia, South Asia, Africa. And so we're talking about a cooperative and co-constituted space, in which these people exist. So Mary Louise Pratt's contact zone. But what I actually found was that in South Africa, these collectors only viewed their African labor as another commodity or another thing that they had to spend money on. So labor was just another thing alongside the preservation materials they needed for specimens that they had to spend money on. And they often complained that sort of the local Africans that would help them charged too much, you know, for their labor and weren't worth anything. So in this period, when we see the sort of Northern and Eastern Cape, there's a huge shifting of political units happening. We call this sort of the Mfecane, but, you know, even this term is loaded and contested. And this is kind of in the time of Shaka, which we presume, you know, Shaka was just, you know, in control of everything and brutally sort of going through Southern Africa. So in these shifting sort of political units that are happening at the time, there are people who turn to banditry, and these people are misunderstood as sort of cannibals, right? So then this is how we get different ideas of things like thievishness and that Africans didn't want to labor for whites. And so then we start getting these misunderstandings about African peoples in Southern Africa, which then fundamentally shape how they were viewed by sort of white Boers and Germans, which these Germans certainly fall into. And they use these same categories to explain how African labor works for them. And so in that sense, they kind of fit into exactly what you would think a relationship would be between sort of a German natural history collector and an African assistant, or the Africans that they encountered, one in which they saw themselves as superior and the Africans as inferior, and that these Africans were just commodities that they could purchase and get rid of at their own disposal.
It is somewhat tragic that this commodification, perhaps even objectification of people, obviously, in particular African laborers and tribesmen, occurred even in the 1800s. But I suppose, as you mentioned, that is somewhat to be expected of relationships between Europeans and those that they colonized, or at least interacted with in a colonizing space at the time. So then I think linking to that, of course, these were not just perceptions that the German nature collectors had in isolation. They obviously, I assume, shared these perceptions of the Africans with their colleagues back home, with the people who they interacted with, and with other white botanists and scientists as well. How did this sort of impact the view of Africa and sort of Africans as a whole, perhaps in South Africa, by the Germans or by indeed Europeans? And did that sort of just feed into the colonial lobby which was forming around the time?
Well, there's an interesting, I think, in a sense, it's exactly what you expect, right? It contributes to derogatory and often racist views of Africans, which people were already starting to form through so-called disciplines like phrenology. You know, so it just reinforced, you know, information that was already coming through about Africa into Europe. But in a sense, I have a good example. In, you know, that kind of has to do with cannibals. So I just have my notes up. So in 1828, a Hamburg newspaper reported that Shaka had invaded a certain part of sort of the Eastern Cape. And people believed that the Xhosa and the Zulu ate their prisoners. And so this feeds into this misunderstanding about cannibals. But all three, you know, there's a set of brothers who respond to their family, who says, "Are you in danger in the Cape? We hear that the Zulu are eating, you know, their prisoners that they take." And they say, you know, and let me just warn, I'll put these in quotations, you know, that one of them said that the author of the article must, quote, must have been a leg puller or an ignoramus, stating that he, quote, knew of no case where the South African, quote, natives have eaten human flesh. Another brother said, quote, South African primitives are not gourmets like the Australians and prefer mutton and beef, end quote. And then the third brother said that he had not, quote, been eaten up by savages. No cannibals have been seen yet. So they're quipping about this idea that cannibals exist, when in reality, so not only, but they're dispelling these rumors, right? So not only do they promote or reinforce ideas about Africans which are circulating about them in Europe, but they also counter information and which would be negative information about sort of indigenous peoples in Africa as well. So it shows kind of this, how local knowledge helped to shape and inform global understandings of Southern Africa, right? So, because these ideas would have then spread, although the idea of the cannibal is very sort of usual sort of in indigenous situations, you know, colonized as cannibals is a sort of a well-known trope. They also sort of dispelled that information, which I think is very interesting.
It's an interesting quotation, and it's a rather nice story that you brought up. I do find it somewhat, not alarming perhaps, but it's interesting that in one of the quips they say, if I'm not misquoting correctly, like the Australians.
Yes,
that's a rather interesting thing, that they bring in another group of natives, so to speak, to compare with, as if the Australians are also meant to be cannibals, if I'm not getting that wrong. How typical of the European imperialists at the time. But anyways, I think leading on from that, so of course, all these efforts, all these sort of predates the unification of Germany by a fair bit, and indeed any sort of formal colonial efforts by them. When, I'm not sure if your research got into this, but when Germany did acquire the foundations of an empire, were these nature collectors, did they then seek out further operations and further botanic expeditions in their own sort of formal imperial, like, homeland, so to speak? Or did they just continue within the South African Cape as they did, even though the British were there and they had the alternative of going to a more, presumably more familiar colonial area?
I mean, the same kind of thing continues. I mean, this is why the 19th century is particularly interesting, is because there's such freedom of movement. They could come, you know, as long they could come and move around as they wished. And this happened throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. Even after Germany loses its colonies, you see actually a shift. Many Germans from Namibia just then move into South Africa and start, you know, conducting scientific inquiry there in a variety of fields. So veterinary medicine, biology. So Robert Koch comes down and has inquiries in South Africa. So, and you see this happening everywhere. There's kind of a little historiographical thing happening now where, quote, Germans are everywhere. And so you see Germans popping up, whether in the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century. Germans, especially in scientific pursuits, are everywhere. So this is something happening in Southeast Asia, South Asia, Africa, Australia, South America, that you kind of see these Germans popping up throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century and making these kind of contributions. So I think, you know, using before and during the time where they have a formal empire, I don't think actually that much changes. They have a place to go, but Germany's formal empire was very, very small. I'll say this with a grain of salt, they barely wanted the colonies anyway, because they were such a huge drain economically and for not very much that they, you know, if we're talking about what they got out of it, you know, very few resources and everything else. So I don't think often that the two things add up, that Germans just went where they wanted to go. And they did that either within the German empires, in their colonies, or they found other places to go. And it was still relatively free for them to do that.
So it's interesting, once again, how that there is no sort of major difference in how they operate even after Germany acquires a formal empire. And I think I would somewhat agree with you and also take that grain of salt that Germany didn't quite get what it wanted from its colonial ventures, even if those ventures were wholehearted or otherwise. So it's interesting also how you mentioned that the Germans are very active and very much associated by their European colleagues with information, with this idea of scientific pursuit in a sort of imperial framework, so to speak. So that leads on to my next question then, which is a bit bolder and a bit bigger. Can scientists sort of become agents of imperialism in their own sort of way? And how do you sort of see that in your research?
Absolutely. I think this is something that is taken as a given, I think, in the history of science. We know that naturalists and scientists are agents of imperialism because if you think about it, they use African bodies for their own research. And, you know, whether it's as direct as that, or whether we talk about there's a concept called the imperial cloud, which is where you have a sort of trans-imperial meeting of sort of European powers in order to talk about scientific findings. So a friend of mine works on colonial wine production in South Africa and Australia. She uses this concept of the imperial cloud to talk about how they solve the problem of phylloxera, which is a sort of insect, a bug that infects vines and vineyards. So all of these sort of European and white settler colonies came together and discussed how they could deal with phylloxera. And this often had disastrous effects for the local environment, the local people of the colonies where phylloxera was found. So you can certainly say, you know, using that example, that it impacted greatly the sort of local commerce, local people, the local environment, and change oftentimes sort of changed or made reinforced the violence of the colonial experience, when especially when they would meet and discuss all these things. Then you start seeing patterns of, you know, we talked about how, you know, there's the stereotype that Indigenous people were cannibals across the British Empire, but science was used in similar ways when they would get together and solve these scientific problems that were happening across colonies and across empires. So I think absolutely scientists were not only reinforced, but fundamentally shifted the imperial experience sometimes in how they dealt with problems. And in my own work, I mean, I certainly think, you know, even just the collection of specimens and the way in which they did this, you know, whether this be the types of materials that they use for preservation, or, you know, I talk about the collection of human remains, you know, there's certainly an idea of conquest. So this idea of ambition and risk-taking that's inherent in the collection process fundamentally damages the natural environment and damages local people and their customs. You know, they exhumed human remains while African onlookers sort of looked at them in horror. You know, why are you taking these human remains? So they're fundamentally desecrating, you know, the cultural and religious rights of African groups. So for me, that's if that's not an agent of colonialism, I'm not sure what else.
I definitely say that's a very vivid agent of colonialism right there. And it certainly links to this sort of where there's a dominant thinking in popular history to think of science as contributing to imperialism wholeheartedly. Indeed, you know, this is the sort of the age of scientific racism, so to speak, to justify imperialism and the white man's burden and so forth. But it is also interesting, as you note, and as others have definitely worked on, that science also can be a force, in quotations, for good within the sort of imperial project, as you mentioned, with problem solving and the sort of collective use of information to shape responses to problems in colonies and problems throughout the empire as well. I think, I think as a sort of final question then, would it be fair to say that German nature collectors and these botanists in South Africa, did they sort of fashion their own empire of information, so to speak? And what sort of constituted that empire, if it ever did exist?
Well, I wouldn't say Germans, you know, this is essentially a cosmopolitan story, which is led by a group of Germans. I'm wary to say that it's, you know, this is completely a story of Germans and German science, although that's what I push forward. But that's just to make sure that they're recognized as being present in this moment. But they certainly, there is an empire of information in a sense. But actually what I found with these nature collectors is that the plants they collected themselves, so if we talk about non-human agency, the collections, the sheer magnitude of the collections that they collected, and things like emotions that kind of go, you know, which are all the main themes of my research, that they actually fundamentally disrupted the empire of information that they attempted to build. So I, you know, we can question the idea of scientific progress in quotes, but what I found is that actually, because these collectors had competition between one another, that competition actually was more destructive for the natural world and for our understanding of South African flora at this time. Because they decided to bring their collections to sale in Europe separately, they completely disrupted how we put together, or how botanists at the time put together this information, how they classified these plants into different taxonomic categories. So I find that ultimately competition disrupts the empire of information, if we want to call it that. They couldn't, you know, ultimately their competition destroyed all the work that they attempted to do and all the money that they attempted to make. And so at the end, I think you have people with a really ambiguous legacy. When you have South African botanists in the 1880s and 1890s, who start looking at this material again, and they say, actually, their commercial pursuits destroyed any use of these collections because they're labeled wrong. They are, you know, there's too many synonyms, you know, so idea, different names of plants that you give before you finally land on the final taxonomic category. So it's chaos and confusion rather than this, you know, this often understood sort of narrative of scientific quote progress, that it was simple and straightforward and then everything goes in a linear progression. Actually, these people are disruptors of information.
Well, at the risk of being a bit of a, at the risk of overgeneralizing, that I would definitely say that it's interesting how you mentioned all of that, because I think uncertainty, chaos, confusion, and sort of nebulous, to use your favorite word, are all aspects of history that we grapple with as historians in the past as well. A narrative is very rarely as clean and as neat as some popular history narratives make it to be in the media, makes it out to be. There's always more to be said about, as you've mentioned, of course, the on the one hand, the cooperation that the German natural history collectors facilitated with the Boers and the British, but also, of course, the competition with, between them, between the groups and within the groups as well, and how that sort of factored into their actions and the overall legacy which they've left, indeed. So if there's nothing else from you, I think we can end it here. But do you have anything to say before we cop it off?
I don't think so. I mean, just thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk about my research. And, you know, it's great to be on a podcast and have a discussion with you about it.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was absolutely lovely talking with you about this. Like, at the risk of being somewhat funny, I would say we had a very good harvest of information from this podcast. But yes, this was the LSE Beaver Sound History Podcast, Botanists in the Belly of Britannia. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you for listening to Archive Chats. Be sure to check out the other Beaver Sound podcasts on Spotify and all other social media, and we'll see you in the next episode.